I'd like to welcome everyone here today. I know many of you are here to hear Dr. Carol Newsom. We've really enjoyed having her be our lecturer for this year's Interfaith Scholar Net weekend. And Dr. Newsom grew up in Birmingham, Alabama, and received her AB degree at Birmingham Southern College. She earned her Master's of Theological Studies at Harvard University and her PhD at Harvard. And she has had the great good fortune to do research and do the translation of the Dead Sea Scrolls known as the Song of the Sabbath Sacrifice. Let us welcome to our pulpit today, Dr. Carol Newsom. Let's give her a good, warm welcome.
Well, you heard the words of Job, but what did he actually say? And what did he mean? And what was it that he has now seen that caused him to speak like that? These are the last words Job speaks in the book. They come very near the end of what has been a strange and perplexing book. Nothing happens the way we expect. Nothing happens the way we would have predicted. There was Job, everything going well for him, and suddenly his life becomes an unrecognizable abyss of pain. His friends come to comfort and console him, and instead they end up berating him. And Job, the very symbol of patient endurance, becomes unrecognizable even to himself. Now he's furious, at times almost raving with rage and indignation at the God he had loved and trusted. And yet even in his fury, he can't seem to turn his back on God. His anger itself rises like a broken prayer. So one expects that in the end, God's going to appear and answer Job's passionate questioning, give him the explanation that he's been seeking. And God does appear, but hardly with the answers to Job's persistent questions. Instead, God chooses to talk about the cosmos, the sea, the light of dawn, the gates of deep darkness, the path of light, the stars, the clouds, the rain, and of course the animals, ravens, lions, mountain goats, onagers, ostriches, and the terrifying behemoth and leviathan. It is all so strange. Now, one would expect that Job again would be furious. He hasn't gotten the answers to his questions. Instead, he seems strangely quiet. He quotes a few words that God has spoken to him, and then he says that he's now seen with his eyes. And then there's that enigmatic last line. It is the despair of translators, because the Hebrew is utterly ambiguous. If you compare the different translations, you get very different interpretations. In the NRSV or the NIV, "Therefore I despise myself and repent upon dust and ashes." That is, I repent in humiliation. Or in the translation from the Tanakh, the Jewish Publication Society that we heard this morning, "Therefore I recant and relent, being but dust and ashes," that is, being merely human, the same phrase that Abraham had used at one point to distinguish humans from gods. Now, both of those translations suggest in different ways that God has somehow broken Job, or at least overwhelmed him. But there's another way that some translate that last line. "Therefore, I retract my words, and I'm comforted concerning dust and ashes." That is, comforted concerning the human condition. Now, that's provocative. Job's friends certainly didn't comfort him. And as we read God's strange speeches to Job, it hardly seems like those are comforting words. "Where were you," God booms, "when I laid the foundations of the earth?" Or God's sarcasm, "Surely you know." So I think you can see why many of the translators assume that Job has just been overwhelmed by this Cecil B. DeMille style God from the whirlwind. But I'm intrigued by the possibility that Job did hear something that in fact comforted him. In fact, if that's the case, that he was comforted, then it would make some sense out of that final strange and unexpected thing that happens at the end of the story. That is, the prose conclusion, when Job's brothers and sisters come to be with him and offer him support, and he recovers his fortune and has 10 more children. Now, a lot of people really don't like this ending. The happy ending seems all too neat. New children do not replace dead children. They do not. So if this is God's way of making it all okay again, then it just doesn't wash. Now, there are a lot of things that might still puzzle and disturb us about this ending that we could spend an entire weekend talking about, but I've only got 15 minutes for this sermon. But I don't think that the point of this ending is that Job gets everything back and so it's okay. No, I really don't think that's what it's about. Instead, I think it has to do with the way in which the Hebrew Bible talks about what it means to grieve and what it means to be comforted. In the Old Testament, when people grieve, they tear their clothes. Sometimes they cut their hair. They refuse food. They sit on the ground. They throw dust on themselves. They weep. They moan. They express in very physical ways the desolation that they're feeling. Now, usually this period of active grieving would only go on for a limited period of time. Now, that doesn't mean that at the end of that they'd finished emotionally grieving. We know that can take years. But at the end of this period of very public grieving, they got up, they washed themselves, they put on clean clothes, they ate, they drank, and they had sex. Grieving was a time of entering into a death-like condition in recognition of all the loss that had occurred. But concluding that first stage of grieving was a way of acknowledging that the person understood that life continued and that they were willing to participate in living. That's what it meant to be comforted, to be willing to live rather than to let death and loss have the last word. And so the ending of the book of Job, I think, is a way of saying that finally Job left the ash heap where he had been sitting, and he was willing to re-enter life. He ate with his brothers and his sisters who had come to be with him. He went back to the business of making a living, and he had sex with his wife, a profound symbol of entering into life because it's the act of bringing new lives into being. This is the means by which the Lord restored the fortunes of Job, through Job's own being willing to leave the ash heap and take up living again. Now, Job's second family is not a replacement for his first, but it's rather an indication that now, knowing everything that he knows about what can happen, he still makes the choice to live again and have children. And this is what the ancient Israelites would have recognized as the picture of a person who has been comforted. Job's questions, God's answer. Apparently, he did find it enough to be comforted, to be willing to live. But just a minute. Job's questions, but what about our questions? It's not difficult for anyone to make Job's questions his or her own. Most of us haven't suffered the complete devastation that Job has experienced, but all of us know enough of misfortune to make his questions our own. We're standing in the midst of an economic meltdown, with jobs disappearing, institutions quaking, and uncertainty terrifying us, and it all seems so crazy and inexplicable. We read about, and sometimes we encounter in our own experience, cruelty so outrageous that it just defies understanding. We go to the doctor in the morning for a minor symptom, and by noon we're grappling with the all but incomprehensible news that we have cancer. People of different ethnic groups who've lived peacefully with one another for decades suddenly form mobs and kill one another, and it makes no sense. The phone rings at 3 a.m., and it's the police telling us that our child has been killed in a car accident. There are so many ways that lives can fall apart just as suddenly as Job's did, with the messengers arriving one after another, hardly finishing with one disaster before another is revealed. And very often the response of people to such incomprehensible loss is that long, painful word, why? Why did this have to happen? Why? 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 Well, I don't know if you've ever been in the situation of uttering that question, or if you've been in the situation of having someone ask it of you. But in my experience, despite the fact that the word why seems to ask for an answer that explains a reason, that's actually not what most people are saying when they utter the question, why. And if you try to answer someone who asks why with a reasoned explanation, you will be about as welcome as Job's friends were to Job. There are always plenty of answers to the question why. The folks on NPR can actually explain why our economy tanked. We can explain that drunk drivers cause automobile crashes. We can explain why almost anything happens. No, the question why, when it's uttered in anguish, is not a request for an explanation, not really. Instead, it's a desperate cry. My world no longer makes sense. It's like I'm standing in an earthquake when solid ground is no longer solid, but bucks and heaves like the sea, and there's nothing to hold on to. And I am so overwhelmed, I don't know how to put one foot in front of the next. And that's exactly what Job had said back in chapter 3. The thing I feared has come upon me, and what I dreaded has befallen me. I have no ease, no quiet, no rest. What comes is turmoil. And so Job does ask why. But both Job and his friends make the mistake of trying to respond to his why with explanations. The friends suggest maybe God's trying to teach him something, or perhaps he sinned and this is punishment, or maybe God just has some mysterious reason. Horrible and inappropriate suggestions, all of them. But Job too tries his hand at explanations. Maybe God is just really mean, like a child who likes to stomp anthills just to see the ants run. Or Job is willing to say, okay, maybe I have done something to deserve all this, but prove it, show me, and then I'll be quiet. Well, looking for explanations, as though that was the way to make the world make sense again. It's easy to see why people grasp at them, but that's not what comforts. Not really. And that's why I think if we see Job as in the end comforted, we have to figure what it was that Job hears and sees in God's words from the whirlwind that give him comfort and enable him to enter life again. Now, the very first year of my teaching career, a very young and inexperienced teacher, I taught a class on the wisdom literature, including Job. And there was a middle-aged woman in my class. And one Saturday night, about midway through our course, the police called her house at 3 a.m. and told her that her son had been killed in a car accident. And like Job, her world crashed down around her. When she came back to school about a week later, she came by to talk, and she told me this. She said, on the morning of his funeral, I got out my Bible, and I turned to Job 38, God's speech to Job out of the whirlwind. And why, I said, did you turn to that passage? Because, she said, I needed to know that my pain was not all there was in the world. Because I needed to know that my pain was not all there was in the world. She knew Job's sense of turmoil, that sense of being overwhelmed, in which it does indeed seem as though there's nothing else but one's pain. So what was it in God's speech that she found comforting? Even though God speaks rather harshly to Job to get his attention, God speaks about the world in a way that draws attention to some of its stable structures, the foundations of the earth, the bars and doors that keep the sea from flooding everything, the way in which every dawn is a new creation, the gates of death and deep darkness that keep them from overwhelming life and light. Our pain, our present sense of turmoil, is not all there is. Another time I had a conversation with a missionary couple who served in the Philippines, and they told me that one day they got a phone call. One of their parishioners, an American serviceman who was married to a Filipino woman, had shot and killed her. Would they take the children until other relatives could come for them? And the missionary couple told me that after receiving the children and feeding them and before putting them to bed, they read from the Bible to them. Not Job in this case, but a similar text. They read the creation story in Genesis 1. Why, I asked? Because, they said, these children had just experienced their world giving way beneath their very feet, and they needed to know that there were some reliable and trustworthy structures, and that's what the creation story is about, the reliable structures that make it possible to live, and the God who has made them. Yes, and yet when God speaks to Job, God doesn't just speak about the reliable structures, the limits on death and deep darkness. It starts off that way, but God keeps going, bringing Job finally face to face, not with an image of structure and reliability, but with the very symbols of turmoil, Behemoth and Leviathan. Leviathan who makes the deep boil like a pot. That hardly sounds comforting. What's God doing? Well, Job had been trying to think his way into a world in which everything could be understood in terms of right and wrong, like a law court. Either I'm guilty and so you're right, or I'm innocent and so you're guilty. Every bad thing that happens has to be somebody's fault. But you know, and I know, it's just not that simple. There are wrongful things that are done. God does care about justice. But there's a lot of stuff in the world that just can't be grasped in those terms. There's a lot of awful things that happen that bring our lives crashing down around us that can't be reduced to blame. And even when blame is involved, just settling that issue doesn't deal with all the hurt and the turmoil. And Job simply hasn't been willing to acknowledge the fact of the chaotic. And so God has to insist that he recognize that reality. As a wise friend of mine once said, "What do you mean life isn't fair? Sooner or later, it breaks everybody's heart." Now, a lot of Christians express frustration. So why did God create a world where bad stuff happens? Why didn't God just put an end to it once and for all? Well, in a curious sort of way, and for reasons that I only partly understand, we've developed a very unbiblical notion of God. I think we got it from the Greeks, but it's what a colleague of mine calls the omni-omni-omni view of God. Omniscient, omnipotent, omnivorous. No, not that one. Or creation is starting with nothing and God's making a world, and in the view of many, making a kind of a botched job of it. But that's not the biblical view of God, especially the Old Testament's view. Rather, the Bible sees God as a deity who is presented with a primordial chaos, a primordial mess, tohu vabohu, in the memorable words of Genesis 1. God who's presented with chaos and then starts to create from it, to work with it, to structure it, to push back and to contain, to make a space where light and life can emerge. That's what Genesis says. And that's what God says to Job. "That's what I do, Job. The chaos is real, but I'm real too. And there is no situation of chaos within which I cannot create. There is no place and no person that is God-forsaken. You may feel that your turmoil, your personal chaos, is all that there is, but you are wrong. The chaos is real, but I'm real too. And the God who creates is more powerful than the chaos that threatens to break through its gates and bars and doors." And I think that's what Job sees and hears. And I think that's why he's comforted. And I think that's why he gets up off his ash heap to receive his brothers and his sisters. And above all, I think that's why Job has sex with his wife, why he's willing to bring children into the world. He knows he can't protect them from all the chaos and harm that can occur in any human life. But finally, he again trusts enough to be willing to live. Job's questions, our questions, God's answer. Is it enough? I think Job decides that it is, that he's comforted and willing to take up again his life. And I think that's what my student heard. Her pain was not all there is. Instead, there is a God who can enter into that turmoil and start to create again. And for that, thanks be to God. Amen.